A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dom Harvey Podcast, powered by Generate and Radix. Real quick favor, if you don't do so already, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, or give it a review if you like it. That's it. Helps the podcast grow, and it means you'll never miss an episode, like this one, with Mark Richardson.
Boom, you're out on your ass. I did have contact with Mike King from I Am Hope, just a couple of texts, and he was fantastic.
He is so good at checking in on people, eh?
Yeah, and it was just nice to know that there's someone there who lives in that space who cares about other people and, you know, what they might be going through. Mm. And it was just nice to connect with someone. I wouldn't say that I descended into any level of depression. It was just tough. I just felt like what had happened, it just felt a little unfair at the time and so very sudden and so very quick.
Mark Richardson, the tools down guy from the block. So much coming up in this hour. We discuss his brand new career transition to a financial advisor at Forsyth Barr, becoming unemployed when Today FM shut down and the toll that took on his mental health, reflections on his time as one of the world's best cricketers, including his complex relationship with the late Shane Warne, becoming public enemy number one for a week after he asked the Prime Minister a controversial question on TV, accidentally outing Ryan Bridge on the AM show, and so much more. I've known Mark in passing for over a decade now, I guess, and I've always liked the guy, but it was really cool to sit down for a chat of this depth and duration. Sadly, it is much shorter than I would have liked, and that's my fault. I cocked up the scheduling on my end, which was humiliating. Then Mark had to leave to meet with a client at Forsyth Barr. Still, I think there's something in here for everyone, especially fans of cricket or fans of the man known as Rigger. And we get into that nickname in this chat as well. Just before we pad up and get into the crease, I think that's what you say in cricket, thanks to my sponsors at Generate and Radix. Generate is my personal KiwiSaver scheme, and I'd love it if you would consider making them yours too. I'm embarrassed to say I was in cruise control when it came to my retirement. I had some money going in each fortnight, but I had no idea what fund it was in or what the return was really. I recently moved over to Generate KiwiSaver scheme after meeting up with one of their awesome advisors. That was cool. I asked heaps of dumb questions, but she certainly put me at ease and assured me they were not dumb questions, even though I'm sure they were dumb questions. The meeting was really helpful. I learned stuff about KiwiSaver that I'd never really considered before. And the bottom line is this. If I'd done it sooner, my KiwiSaver savings would be worth more than what they are now, more than likely. If you want to make sure you're making the most of your KiwiSaver account, chat to an advisor now. Head to generatewealth.co.nz. A copy of their product disclosure statement can be found there too. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. This episode is also sponsored by Radix, the official nutrition sponsors of Simone Mayer, who just won her fifth Coast to Coast title. High performance athletes like Simone, they've been fans of Radix for years. Now regular folks like you and I can improve our own lives by using Radix products. The protein powder is incredible, and the freeze-dried, just-add-water meals are impossibly good. You honestly do have to try them for yourself. Check them out. Radix is spelled R-A-D-I-X. Their website, radixnutrition.co.nz. So thanks again, Radix and Generate. Okay, let's get into it. Mark Rigger Richardson on the Dom Harvey Podcast.
Well, I've heard about this podcast, you know, many, many times. You've had some great guests, and it's one of the more well-known ones, I guess, around in New Zealand.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm not just saying this. You, for me, are a dream guest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We've worked together over the years. I wouldn't describe us as friends, but we worked in the same building, and I always enjoyed our little, if we were making coffees at the same time, we'd always have a little chat about running, and I always enjoyed our little conversations.
We had similar interests, I think.
Yeah, that's
the thing.
Clint Randall, who was my co-host, he came back to the studio one morning. He said, oh, I was just in the bathroom the same time as the tools down guy from the block, and fuck, he's nothing like that in real life. So I think people are surprised when they meet you because you're quite gregarious on TV, and in real life, you're quite sort of, I don't know, introverted, I guess.
I think a lot of people are like that. Yeah, I mean, you're a magnification yourself. I think you have to be in broadcasting, or you come across as a little flat.
Mm.
And then you can put on top of that the persona I created, or the brand that I tried to create via Crowd Goes Wild, and then at the AM show, people, you know, thought I must have been a complete ass. And I hope when they got to know me, you know, they realised that's not the case. A lot of it is performance, as you know.
It has to be. It has to be like an extension of yourself, or like a character to a degree, because otherwise it's just fucking boring.
Yeah. When I did The Crowd Goes Wild, I tried to work on the brand that I'm going to be everything that I would love to be but could never be. And that's what I worked on. Mm.
So who is the real Mark Richardson then? I always found you quite charming and friendly.
I think a homebod for a start, pretty conservative, very conservative, competitive and driven and wanting to succeed, but without a doubt, probably quite shy in a social setting. You know, I get very nervous going into a room full of people I don't know. And I think for a long time there, that shyness, you know, often got misconstrued as arrogance, maybe. Right? But that's something that I've always hoped I have not been, and never really taken anything that's happened that's been positive for granted.
No, I've never thought you were arrogant. A fun person, a guy that doesn't take himself too seriously, a guy that can take the piss, but also a guy that can be incredibly serious when he needs to be.
Yeah, I hope just being able to read the situation and deliver what's needed to be delivered. Mm. But yeah, laughing. I think the New Zealand psyche likes people who can laugh at themselves.
Mm.
But in terms of that on-air persona, it was always a big magnification of myself. And when the red light on the camera wasn't on, or the microphone, you know, I tended to be quite reserved.
Mm. Yeah, you and I, we've got quite a few things in common. So we're both introverts, both sort of loners. Mm. I love being on my own. Homebodies as well. And hates crowds.
Yeah.
Oh. I saw some Instagram stories last week. So the last media company you and I both worked for was MediaWorks. And it was the MediaWorks Christmas party. And I saw a few stories there. And I was thinking, oh, I've got a bit of FOMO. But the reality is, if I was still working there, I wouldn't have even gone.
No, I think I went to my first Christmas party that I've been to for a long time, when I went to the Forsyth Bar one. I tended to avoid those sort of social settings. Yeah, you'd stand around sort of trying to make small talk with people. It really doesn't come naturally.
Yeah. Yeah. When I'm at those things, all I'm thinking about is how quickly I can leave without.
Yeah, how long do I have to stay here and for it not to be noticed when I leave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's your role now. You're now a financial advisor at Forsyth Barr.
Yeah. So big change. So yeah, an investment advisor there. So I guess sharebroker and old money, but that's not really how it's done nowadays. Always had an interest in finance and got an opportunity to do it. And obviously going through the accreditation process, but I am a registered financial advisor, so I can give sort of financial advice. But when it comes to maybe, you know, the wider sense, you know, you're under supervision there for quite some time because they can't just let you loose to make all sorts of mistakes, you know, because you're representing the company. So, you know, it's if I do anything, it's under the very, very watchful gaze of some pretty, pretty clued up people there.
Mm. This is a really interesting third act. So I'd say it's like a third act. So there's the cricket career, wildly successful, media career, wildly successful, and hopefully the same now. But it seems like an unusual, like drastic pivot from what you were doing.
Well, they say you have three careers in life, so I'm on to the third and final one, and I need to make it work.
Yeah. Well, your track record would suggest it will work.
It's interesting. You say, you know, successful broadcasting career. I don't feel like it was that successful.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I guess when you're in it, it's an industry whereby I don't think you realise what you have got. Yeah, you might be on primetime TV and radio or what have you, you know, in two different things, but you're always sort of going, well, why am I doing that? Why not on that show?
Oh, you always want more.
Yeah, you always want more. I think it's just that insecurity of it all. Yeah, when I look back at my sport, there's some, there's some things that I were disappointed I didn't achieve. But when I do look back at my cricket career, I go, yeah, you succeeded. You overachieved. Without a doubt, I feel I overachieved in the sporting sense. But in the broadcasting, no, I feel I never really reached where I wanted to get to and then realized that wasn't going to happen.
So are you, I mean, you're still doing cricket stuff. This podcast today was set up by the wonderful Emily at TVNZ. So you're doing cricket commentary. Is that the only media sort of stuff you're doing? You've completely turned your back on it now.
Pretty much. I mean, a lot of that decision was made for me. I can't claim that, I said, no, not interested because the work dried up. So, I love the cricket commentary. That's my passion. I would probably do it for free. If no one can hear that. I'm not saying I want to, but I absolutely love it. And I'm so lucky now that I can have this other opportunity and another career, which hopefully I can still be doing in 10 years' time and succeeding at. And at least for the next 3 years, TVNZ have the rights and hopefully I'll be involved in that because I have a real passion for cricket commentary.
Yeah.
I really do.
Well, this is a massive loss for New Zealand media, I think.
I don't think they think that.
it just does. I'm guessing it's been a rough year for you. So you were doing the AM show and then there were changes there. Then Today FM came along. That only lasted a year. The project's gone as well. And what's happening with The Block?
Well, The Block is officially on hold because the market was down. They really didn't want to take the risk of having unsold properties. Long story short, but when the network also became the production company, then having unsold properties was not good. It would eat into commercial revenue. So the model changed a little bit. So they put it on hold, and that's the last I've heard of it. Haven't really even heard being told. That was over a year ago, and haven't had any correspondence since then or an update on whether even considering it. And I guess I've been forced to move on.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, you can only tread water for so long, can't you? You really need to sort of like draw a line in the sand, I guess, and get on with your life.
Well, I need a life.
Yeah.
I can't put it on hold in the hope that, I can, when The Block comes back, I can do it. But that phone call hasn't come yet. Mm. I don't know if it will come back. There's a lot of water has flown under the bridge, but right now I've heard nothing and I've moved on with another chapter.
You're such a positive guy, but there must have been times over the past year where, I don't know, you're bitter, resentful, depressed, upset.
Yeah, but everything. It was tough because it did. It just all dried up. And it wasn't like I think I was doing a bad job. In fact, I thought the shows I was involved in were doing well. And then, boom, they weren't there. And you get thanked for your time and good luck. And I don't like not having my path mapped out in front of me. I like to see it. And all of a sudden it was, there was, what am I doing? Where am I going?
Mm.
And I think the frustration was the fact that I felt that I was doing a good job. That it's not like I was failing at any of those gigs. And certain things, commercial realities transpired, I guess, and boom, you're out on your ass. I did have contact with Mike King from I Am Hope, just a couple of things, a couple of texts, and he was fantastic.
He is so good at checking in on people, eh?
Yeah, and it was just nice to know that there's someone there who lives in that space who cares about other people and, what they might be going through. Mm. And it was just nice to connect with someone. I wouldn't say that I descended into any level of depression, but it was just tough because I just felt like what had happened, while I understand it happens in the industry that we've been involved in, it just felt a little unfair at the time and so very sudden and so very quick. It just took a bit to get my head around. But really, I absolutely blessed and lucky that another opportunity came around, and an opportunity that, I mean, I would love to be doing what I'm doing now, but I thought that boat had sailed at my age. I was never going to pick up another proper career. And like I'm in, well and truly in finance now. I thought that boat had sailed and all of a sudden realized it hadn't. And, I'm trying to grab onto it with both hands.
Mm. Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Oh, no doubt you'll be successful at it.
Hopefully.
It seems like you're doing a bit of research for this podcast. It's like your superpower is hard work and working out what needs to be done and then just doing it. And it seems like you did that very well with cricket and then with broadcasting, and I can't see how this is going to be any different.
I reckon I'm working harder than I ever worked at university in an academic nature right now. Yeah. I spent hours and hours studying companies, studying macroeconomics, reading reports on this, doing it. There's a lot of compliance, a lot of testing, a lot of examining, a lot of accreditations to go through. You can't get through the early stages of this career without actually accumulating quite a lot of knowledge. The industry demands it of you now. And it's, you know, I'm having to really, I go home exhausted. Well, you know, you go home from doing a radio show or a TV show tied for the performance value of it.
Yeah.
I go home exhausted.
Like your brain
just
hurts.
Because you've just been thinking so hard about stuff. So I enjoy it. Yeah. You know, it's good.
It's cool because there is that saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but you actually can. The old dog just needs to be prepared to learn the new tricks.
Yeah, and the industry that I'm moving into, there's no harm in having life experience because it is relationship-based. People are trusting you with their money, with their nest egg, and yes, they can trust it maybe to a 25-year-old hotshot, but I think if you can, you know, a lot of clients are a little bit older, and if you can resonate with them and connect with them on a personal level, I think it's easier to get that element of trust that you need. And I have to go through a little bit of a rebranding thing because it's one thing. Everyone sort of goes, oh, you'll be really good at this. You'll be really good at this. Because of the connection I have and what I've done in life. And that just puts that pressure of expectation on my shoulders, you know, wanting to live up to those expectations. But I know damn well that, you know, when I'm taking this seriously and I'm not Mark Richardson, the broadcaster any longer, the bloke everyone knows. I need people to see me as Mark Richardson, the bloke who understands the share markets and the debt markets and macroeconomics. And you can trust me with your coin because I'm not going to do something dumb with it.
Yeah, well, if you've got $1 million to invest, you don't necessarily want to give it to the guy that said on live TV he took a dump off the back of a jet ski, do you?
Yeah.
Sorry for bringing that up.
Yeah, there was a need at the time that had to be addressed. And, you know, I knew that the laws, I knew I needed to be in a certain depth and a certain distance offshore. So there was a bit of
I was meticulous.
And thought that went into it to make sure that I didn't break any compliance and regulations.
Yeah. Oh, good on you. We'll double back around. We'll go back and talk about cricket a little bit and then maybe move forward with the career stuff as well. There won't be any deep or insightful cricket stuff here because I know very little about it. Okay. But I have done some research. So your nicknames, there's Rigger.
Yeah, short for rigor mortis.
Yeah, why's that?
Because I have the speed and agility of a dead person. Pretty much stiff, inagile, hopeless fielder. And it was Shane Bond in about mid-90s. So this is going back to when I was actually quite a young man as well. He nicknamed me rigor mortis because he just thought I just looked like an old stiff.
You're very self-deprecating though, like in your book as well, which I've got a copy of, Thinking Negatively. Like you downplay just how good you were and what you did. don't you think?
When I look back, I'm really proud of what I achieved.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that I took some of the world's best bowlers on and succeeded. I was disappointed, but I let myself down in Australia, and that irks me. But yeah, like, I'm pretty proud. Mm. When I look back at my cricket career and what I achieved, I'm pretty damn proud. Mm. It's just not New Zealand. It's just not accepted in New Zealand for me to go. Like, I would say it on air. Oh, it's brilliant. Absolute legend. One of possibly New Zealand's greatest ever opening batter. But people know I'm saying that in a self-depreciation. You know, what is it?
Self-deprecating. Yeah. Tongue in cheek.
Self-depreciating. That's one of my.
And another one of your nicknames, Donut.
Kenzie gave that to me.
So this is Chris Kent. So yeah, he was a teammate of yours, and his dad Lance was one of your coaches.
Yeah. So this was so that goes right back. That's a good one to find, actually. Where'd you find that nickname?
In the forward of your book.
Oh, okay. I think he gave that to me in the under-19s, and I was always a little bit younger in some of those sides. Kenzie was a bit older, and I was a typical stupid kid. Just dumb. So Donut was like, there's nothing in the middle. Yeah. Which is fair enough in those days, you know.
And he, I noticed he calls you Richie.
Yeah,
does anyone call you Richie?
Nah, you'd have to go back. People call me Richie goes right back to the early years, and then that morphed into then became Rigger. And a lot of people on the street call me Rigger, and I sort of like it. See it as a term of endearment. I like the fact that, say, just fans or punters feel they have the right to call me by my nickname, which I find is it's quite humbling that, you know, they feel that they can do that.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, it's a massive term of endearment.
Yeah.
But I mean, the reality is, like, you weren't that slow. And then you started running. Like, you and I bonded over some running chats. You got quite good with your marathons. Like, just, you never broke 3 hours, but you're on the sort of cusp.
I had the, you know, when you do your, because I could do, I had that a 1:21 for a half, which is quick.
1:21. Yeah. That's like 3:50 pace or something.
If you do a 1:21, you should have the fitness to be able to run a sub. Yeah, you're talking probably a 2:50 sort of there.
Mm.
But I would, cramp would get me. I had some structural issues, I think, and I would get to about the 38K mark and kaboom, I'd be running my 4:15 pace. And the minute it started to feel tough and you had to work, I would cramp, and that would be, and I'd just hobble back for, I think, about 3:05 was about the best I did.
Just watch those minutes slipping away.
Yeah, but when it came to the sprinting, like, and being slow, I always felt I could get over 100 okay, but cricket is about running short distances and bending down and being able to move and pick up balls and swoop, and I couldn't do that. I literally had to run over to the ball and then get a step ladder to climb down to pick it up. just didn't have that agility. You know?
Oh, yeah, you see, you mentioned the cramp thing in the perspective of marathon running before. There's that famous clip online of you cramping, and when you're on Crowd Goes Wild, it was played like every other night. How's that? Is that hilarious or embarrassing?
I still laugh at it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so painful.
Yeah, I've had cramp before. It's excruciating. It feels like you're being shot in that body part.
Oh, good God. It was horrendous. And I was so dehydrated. Because I had the old Dally Belly going into that test, so I was pretty dehydrated, and, you know, no one notices the score tick, about 230-something for one. So I've been out there for quite some time. Mm. And it just, like, my body was stuff going into it, so it just shut down. I could cramp playing that shot, which is the only shot I could play to get runs at that point. I'm in the 90s, so I need to get to 100. And I was cramping, and when I'd stretch my calf out, I'd cramp in my quads. So it's literally lying there sort of in a neutral position, which doesn't really stop the pain. And I couldn't, I just, you know, stretch hammy out, quad would go. Start to sort of bend the quad, hammy would go again. It was just horrendous. And then not long after that, when I got into the marathons, I had the same sort of issues with the cramp. I'd go in my hammies. And I can remember coming up the finish chute at Victoria Park here. And the ground announcer, the announcer is, you know, calling people in. They go, oh, it comes Mark Richardson, sort of, you know, I remember, don't cramp, Rigger. And then, boom, I got this massive bout of cramp. I'd been dealing with it for the last couple of Ks. And he's going, oh, there he is, there, hamming it up. And I was like, I'm not hamming it up. I'm actually cramping.
So he thought you were doing a Mark Richardson parody.
I actually stumbled across the line and had to be carried from the line to out the end of the chute by St. John's Ambulance.
Oh, that's humiliating. There's a lot of people in that chute at the finish line.
And I just
probably a thousand.
Yeah, and I just thought people were thinking, oh, what a dick. Look at him hamming up the cramp thing. But it was absolutely legit.
Oh, that's amazing. So you were playing cricket. You were a bowler.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened? I know you're into your golf. Are you familiar with the Ian Baker Finch story?
Well, he sort of lost his golf, didn't he?
Yeah, completely. So Australian guy, really, really good, and then just like lost his game completely, and then became a commentator. Was that the same with you in bowling?
I was a good bowler. I was sort of New Zealand under 19s, and then Auckland as a left arm spinner, and then Otago as a left arm spinner. But when I went to Otago, I'd start to lose it.
What do you mean exactly? How do you explain that to a non cricketer? In your own mind, you must have still been bowling okay.
No, I'd bowl. I was awful. And it started out like I was a good youth bowler, but you always got like you'd bowl a loose-ish ball every over, but at youth cricket, it didn't really hurt you. And then I started playing men's cricket, and I started playing for Auckland. I was still very young. I was about 18. And that loose ball, because good cricketers now, you're bowling to good batters, and they'd be able to sit and defend on your good balls, and then you'd bowl them a bad ball, and they did it for four. And that was too many runs in an over. And I started to fear bowling that bad ball. So you worry, rather than running in and going, I'm going to bowl a good ball, I'm going to show you how good I am, I'm going to rip it, I'd be running in and going, just get this on spot. So now the worry of bowling a bad ball is now the front of your mind, as opposed to it's not in your mind. And so very quickly that takes it from one bad ball to two bad balls to three bad balls to only an over crap, which is what I was bowling, and that was that. And I could bowl on the nets with no fear of consequence. I'd bowl quite nicely, but get to a game, just stiffen up.
Was it just an overthinking thing?
I think that's how my brain works.
Yeah.
I think batting just worked better for me in that regard, that my mind worked.
This is the interesting thing. So you're a bowler, that all happens, you lose your confidence, but at that point you're like a number 10 batsman, which means like you're the shittest batter in the team.
Yeah, one of the worst, yeah.
So then you go away and you sort of reinvent yourself as a batsman, and you end up making the New Zealand team at 29. Kind of from what I can gather, it sounds like you sort of forced your way in. So you weren't on anyone's radar, but it got to the point where you were so good they couldn't ignore you.
I could always bat a little, but you know, not great, a little bit scared of the ball. No real discipline, really didn't have a batting mentality. It happened through club cricket. I could still bowl well at club cricket. I still could, you know, be in the team. And I started to work my way up in the club team batting. And then I ended up sort of batting at three for the club and scoring some runs and really enjoying it. And actually wasn't worried about playing for Otago at this time, was just enjoying playing the sport that I supposedly was meant to love. And so spending a bit more time, getting a bit more interested in batting, got a few more runs, then got into the Otago second 11, but they picked me as a bowler. And I just remember being quite shitty about the whole thing. Like, I'm not a bowler any longer. I batted at eight or something like that. And we were playing against, Canterbury B, and it's Canterbury A. I think in those days you were allowed to call it B. And we were out of the game, and I batted eight. I managed to get through to about 50, but we were dead. And we ended up needing 33 off the final over to win. And I hit five sixes, hit a three, and won the game.
That's like some Jimmy Neesham Big Bash stuff. So yeah. 33 off the last over, so five sixes
in a row, and then I nicked the last one, which I should have for six as well. Nicked the last one down to third man, and we ran three and won the game. And that got me noticed, and that actually got me a game in the Otago side.
Yeah.
Actually, they're saying, you know, perhaps Rigger can bat a bit here.
But that's not the sort of batsman you were. Like, boring.
No, I started out very a shot maker with Otago. So I worked my way into the Otago side. And in fact, the first 100 I ever got in any form of cricket was in a first class game of cricket. And I wasn't even meant to be yet in the team. We had an academic called James Allen, whose graduation was at the time that we were going to play Central Districts. And so he pulled out late doors because graduation was more important than playing cricket for Otago. And so I got called into the side and went and got 100 and it never batting at five and never looked back. But I was a stroke player. I used to play a lot of shots. And but I realized I had to find a way to go from averaging 30 in both 1 dayers and 4 dayers to having a couple of seasons where I averaged in the 60s or 70s. Mm. And I started to realize I needed to actually shelve a bit of the aggressive intent and bring it back. And and that just went, you know, that I just refined that skill, and I just worked out that surviving was my best way of succeeding.
That 33 off one over, just, I'm sorry, I just can't get past that. I looked at a lot of stuff on YouTube prior to you coming around today. Does footage of that exist anywhere?
No, it was Geraldine. That's Geraldine, amazing, Domain, or wherever.
Why is that not a better known Mark Richardson story? That's outstanding.
I guess it was just playing for the Otago second 11 that doesn't really get any sort of coverage. But that was the real turning point for me. Just an over of just whacking it turned my career around. Yeah, just one of those things. Maybe I would have continued to score runs, and you know, I would have found myself there eventually. Mm. But no, that freakish sort of act really sort of turned everything around for me.
Yeah, and I've heard you say your Everest, that like the highlight of your career is getting that century at Lords.
Yeah.
So first innings you got 93, and then the second innings you got 101. How do you feel when you get out at 93?
Because I know I wasn't out too. Bloody nicked it onto my pad and was really going out. Yeah, so, but almost made it almost easier. I mean, shed all over here.
So
I was just pleased I'd scored runs. Yeah, I'd gone there and I'd got 93 in the first innings at Lords. And I was like, well, I'd actually done something significant. And then all I thought in the second innings was, okay, just back it up with a reasonable total. So, because I used to hate getting a decent score and then almost taking that for granted, look bad if you went out and got a poor second innings score. So I just sort of gripped my teeth and thought, well, we'll just see how many I can get in the second innings. And then it just got closer and closer and closer to the point it's like, shit, maybe I can get 100. and I did, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So how do you get out on 101? In your book, you talk about Stephen Fleming saying to you, don't give up on yourself. Did you give up on yourself after getting 100?
Yeah, I sort of did, and cricket is a great game because it'll always beat you up if you allow it to beat you up. And I can remember I got this 100, and it was the achievement of my life, and it was just before tea, and I went in at tea, not out, and just all the adrenaline drained from me. And when I went out to bat after tea, I couldn't get myself up to start again. It was just such a huge achievement for myself, you know, and I needed to pick myself up because I only needed to bat for another half an hour to an hour, and we probably would have batted us our way to safety in the game and been in totally dominant. I got out playing a very loose shot because I just wasn't there mentally. Mm. And then the English bowling attack, which was a good attack actually, they rolled our middle and tail from there, and we ended up losing the test. And so I sort of go, greatest moment of my life, but also a moment in which I arguably let my team down and lost the game as well.
God, that's a terrible way of looking at it. Come on.
But that's
194 runs over two innings.
It's your day. It's your game, and you've got to make the most of it. And, you know, this is what I love about Kane Williamson, and I really believe him. He's so frustrating to interview because he's just played one of the greatest hundreds you've ever seen in life. And you go and talk to him, and it's set a record here and there, and it's like, well, the situation of the game. And he'll never talk about anyone. He'll never talk about himself. Mm. He always talks about the situation of the game. And I think the actual number that he walks away with is totally and utterly irrelevant to what was required in the situation of the game. What makes gets him out of bed in the morning to play cricket is what I need to do for my team today in this game of cricket.
So personal achievements on the back burner.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's always bittersweet when you get, you know, I still the highlight of my life, get 100 at Lords, but then I dig a bit deeper and it's like, well, you should have got 130, 140, and you wouldn't have lost the game.
But so you get 100 at Lords. That means Lords, by the way, I don't want to patronise anyone, but like the home of cricket, right?
Yeah, prestigious, it's a spiritual ground. Home of cricket.
Yeah, so you get your name on an honours board there. Is there a ceremony or anything? What happens?
Yeah, your name goes up on the board in the visitors' changing shed. They just put it up. They put it up on tape because they can't get in and engrave it. I've actually never seen it engraved. I've never.
Have you not? Not commentated there. So you've never seen.
I've never seen my name on the honours board actually engraved in there.
How would that be?
I think I'd be quite emotional to tell you the truth because it was such a big thing. For cricketers.
I suppose the older you get, the more emotional that moment will become.
I think you value.
Yeah.
You value what you did. I mean, your career becomes a half hour's highlights package. You know, you tend to remember the good stuff, but there's some bad stuff that, you know, irks me a little bit.
What's the bad stuff?
Oh, bad stuff was how I performed in Australia.
Okay. So, this is when you decided to retire. Yeah, just after this. So you left the game on your own terms. What happened? I can't remember it at all.
I think
was it real bad or was it just bad in your own head?
After England, I'd reached a pinnacle for myself and I'd had a great series. And then, but I was also, I didn't want to be me any longer. I didn't want to be that stuff. There was no fun in it. And I wanted to actually have a bit more fun and enjoy the art of batting a bit more and play a few more shots and be able to put a bit more pressure. I would have got more hundreds had I been more attacking because I wouldn't have had to face so many balls and I would have put more pressure on bowlers. And there was times in innings where I could have actually played aggressively, but I pulled myself back. And I really, there was no fun in that. And then I went to Bangladesh and thought, right, well, I'm going to smash Bangladesh. And I didn't. I nicked out a couple of times badly. And then I went to Australia and I was like, you know what? All I can do is just defend against these guys and hang in there. I didn't have the skills to take them on aggressively. And I just thought, you know what? I just don't want to be here. And in Australia against that Australian bowling attack is no place to be when you don't want to be there. And I just got spat out. But it was even the series before that, no one. I was at the top of my game. And I scored some runs against Australia. I got good starts. I got a couple of 30s and a 50. And I didn't let myself actually play the cricket against them that I should have.
Mm.
I should have got at least a big 100 on that tour in those conditions because I didn't believe I could do it against Australia. I'd pedestaled them because this is the proving grounds for New Zealand cricketers, Australia, because we grew up watching Australia from cricket. It's great viewing hours. Or people my age loved the Channel 9 commentary team, the legends of commentary.
Yeah, and the 12th man tapes. And
here
CDs.
We are. It's us doing it now. And the same, sort of the same commentary team, Tony Gregg and Bill Laurie and Richie Benaud, and they're commentating on me. And I just didn't realize I actually belonged there and could dominate. The greatest compliment I've ever been paid in the game of cricket was once I stopped playing cricket. And Ricky Ponting, who still frightens me to this day and intimidates me to this day, we're at the New Zealand Golf Open. And someone came up to me and started talking and it was about my cricket or something like that. And Ricky was standing close by putting on the green. And I'd never really had much to do with Ricky. He still intimidated me. When I'd do the toss as a broadcaster, my hand would shake and the microphone would shake. He intimidated me that much.
Wow.
And I didn't think he really thought much of me as a cricketer because I had never done that well in Australia. And he said to this guy, he said, this guy could really play. He just didn't let himself play. And that was possibly, coming from Ricky Ponting, that was the greatest compliment ever paid to me. I nearly started crying on the bloody putting at the hills.
Do you suffer imposter syndrome, do you think?
Maybe a little. Yeah.
So that doesn't keep you awake at night anymore, does it?
Australia does, my performance in Australia.
Actually?
Yeah, I still
you still have regrets about that?
Yeah, still a lot of regrets.
So how many years ago?
I think I'll carry that to the time. It's 20 years ago now. But I'll still.
But you're not thinking about it daily?
Sometimes.
About
3 months.
It
really irks me because I let myself down. And I shouldn't have. And in a professional sense. And that really pissed me off.
Mm.
Yeah.
Unreal. So I had Shane Cameron on the podcast and he talked about that that horrible beating he got from David Tua. And he said it was 7 years, he reckons, before he realised one day that he hadn't thought about it. So 7 years just was on his mind. But you being bullied by Australia, how many years? Like 20 years ago.
Oh, look, it ruins my enjoyment of watching Australia play and watching the cricket from Australia because it's like you just let yourself sit down so badly.
Yeah. Oh, Oh, yeah. One thing I forgot to mention. So at Lord's, when you're out there getting 101, your wife Mary's there and she meets Mick Jagger?
Yeah, she's hobnobbing with Mick Jagger.
Whereabouts? Like in a corporate box or something?
Yeah, I think he was in the same box as the Wags. Yeah, we got a photo of Mick Jagger and my wife. It was quite a highlight for her. She was pissed off when I was retired because she just got used to the Wag lifestyle. And I came home one day and just said, honey, I've retired. And it was like, you didn't run that past me. She was just starting to enjoy it.
Did you have any recollections of the Mick Jagger moment, or was it just like literally a photo opportunity?
Classic. Because he was with them all day. Yes, it's classic, like he's tiny. He's a funny little fellow. But he was really nice and personable and
loves his cricket, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. That was quite a highlight for her, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, another highlight. You had an opening partnership with Lou Vincent, which remains to this day like one of the best opening partnerships ever. Didn't you? Like
could be. I think
232 runs or something.
Yeah, I think that was the one in which I cramped, the game in India in Mahali.
Right.
Yeah, me and Louie put on a big total there. Louie was great to bat with. Yeah. I like batting with those sort of hyper, sort of because they bring a bit more out of me as well, and I used to bat quite well with them.
He was fun to watch as a fielder as well. It was really exciting.
And also when you have a guy like that who's essentially nuts, you know, personality wise, fun.
Was he nuts? Enthusiastic. Nuts in what way? Just like
just really enthusiastic.
Energizer bunny.
Yeah, energizer bunny. They're good mid pitch as well. You know, I either like batting with guys who were very light in the middle, right? And, you know, we're going to do this and we're going to, you know, and got very technical and we coached each other through. Or I like batting with guys who you didn't know what they were going to say when you sort of came together at the end of the over. Mm. Yeah.
So, did you reach out to him or Ken's when all the match fixing stuff goes down?
Are you still in touch with Louie? I texted the other day. Actually, I was really stoked for him that
he's a lifetime.
Yeah, his lifetime ban. I think that was really unfair. He came clean. He's one of the very very few who said, "Yeah, it was me. I fessed up. Sorry, been wrong." And they tried to make an example of someone that I don't think they needed to make an example out of. Gave him a lifetime ban. So I'm really pleased that they've overturned that, Louie. Because he's a nice guy, and he, I think he had a few issues, you know, mentally at that time, and I think he was taken advantage of. Chris, I came to my wedding, I'd call him a mate. We drifted apart and haven't really stayed in touch. I mean, I feel sad for what's happened to him, and boy, you know, he was a guy, big, strapping, larger than life, superhuman. It just shows how fragile we all are, and Once you wander down Sniper's Alley, you don't know what the hell's going
on. Do you follow him on Instagram? Are you on Instagram at all?
No, I'm not a social media type guy. I've always thought social media is a cancer on society, so I'm tending to stay away from it.
But he shares a lot of his progression, and he's making great progress.
Oh, look, I wish him the best. He, you know, but I just drifted apart. Mm. Really, sorry.
Right.
I think there was, you know, to be perfectly honest, I can remember you rang me up one day after I was doing a show with Andrew Mulligan on Radio Sport, and it was a fun show, and it was around match fixing, and we were running an amnesty, and you had to ring us up and tell us how you cheated in sport, and then I was like the judge, and I was going to hand down your penalty or, you know, and what you had to do, and it was quite a fun little segment. Yeah. And he rang me up afterwards. I was driving home, and he sort of tried to. He just tried to bully me into a bit of silence that he didn't need to do. And I tend to be the type of person that just goes, you know what? I'm wiping my hands, you know?
Yeah. I mean, on probability, he's probably guilty, but I mean, with what he's been through now with the disability and the rehab, it kind of puts into perspective.
And look, no one, whether he's guilty or not, and I've sort of stayed away from that and I don't want to judge.
No.
I've never been privy to, you know, any of the real genuine information, and he's always denied it vehemently. No one wanted to win more. When I was playing for New Zealand and I was in the same teams as him, no one wanted to win more at that point in time than Chris Cairns. And if he was involved in anything, it was in games that wasn't internationals and you know, it was in games that I probably had little respect for anyway. Mm. And saying that, you know, you're still playing sport and corruption's corruption, mm. and, you know. So, but the Chris Kenz I knew desperately wanted to win cricket games for New Zealand to the point that, you know, at times he could get a little bit harsh on us who weren't performing.
Is that right? That's interesting. I've been going to I've been reading a book called Relentless by this guy who's a personal trainer and mental skills coach of some of the best NBA players ever, Jordan, Kobe, LeBron, and he says the same sort of thing about them. Like Jordan was just like an absolute cunt to some of his teammates.
Yeah.
Like there was some Australian dude at the Chicago Bulls, and Scottie Pippen said to him, "Oh, we need you to bring your A game today." And Jordan said, "A game? Just bring a game." Can you imagine how awful that would be hearing that from MJ?
You got to. Like, it's a tough environment, professional sport, and you've got to, you will not succeed at the international level or at a high level of sport if you're not prepared to play, if you can't get the job done uncomfortable. And so you've got to accept the nerves and anxiety and the self-doubt is there, and you've got to find a way of overcoming it. And every now and then I think someone does need a bit of a hurry up. It's like, you're giving in to yourself. You're a better player than this. You need to. You need to. I know it triggers people, but you need to harden the hell up. This is not a fun environment. And every now and then you need someone to give you that, you know, don't, you know, look around. These guys need you to perform. Don't let them down through being weak.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need that. And, you know, Kenzie would dish that out.
Did he ever give you a memorable spray?
I can remember a couple of sprays for not, you know, mainly it was if I'd let myself down. You know,
but surely at that point you already know you've let yourself down.
Yeah, you beat yourself up. Probably don't someone else to beat you. You know, I used to really take quite hard. I just always thought when you're playing for your country, there was no excuse for playing a bad shot because you are there's so many more eyes on you, and you are representing not only yourself but you're representing the cricket fans and followers in your country. They'd love to be out there doing it. Mm. So you don't take the piss. You don't take it lightly. You don't take it for granted. And I always felt there was no excuses for playing a weak shot. You were going to play them from time to time, but there was no, it wasn't just your career. Mm. You know, you're playing for New Zealand. Well, what's New Zealand? New Zealand's 5 million people.
Mm. When you fucked up or you had a cheap wicket or got out with a dumb shot, how were you after that? I had Susie Bates on the podcast, and she said she'd go to the toilet and like have a subtle cry without the team knowing. And
the self-loathing and the anger and the frustration, you know, you'd walk off and I'd think, right, well, that's it. That's the last shot. Yeah, play for New Zealand, isn't it? You know,
or because you're scared you're gonna be dumped.
And then I can remember one game climbing underneath the I got out early, climbed underneath the classic seats that go around the outside of a changing shed. Mm-hmm. I literally wouldn't take anything off, climbed underneath the seats and stayed there for two sessions. Didn't move. Just so pissed off with myself. Just didn't want to talk to anyone, just didn't want to exist in that moment.
But then,
probably a little unhealthy. Some guys could just like, some guys just take the pads off and bang them. The players, you know, they get over in 5 minutes, and that's not a criticism of them. It's just that's how they.
Yeah, well,
they needed to get over it if they were going to be able to go out and bat with confidence. Whereas me, I needed to beat myself up for as long as it took to go out there and then apply myself again.
But it seems like you've always been like that. Like in the foreword at the beginning of your book that Chris Kenz wrote, like he talks about you as a bowler. Apparently you sledged yourself harder than any of the people you were bowling to.
Probably did, yeah. Yeah.
Is this just your personality? Were you like this with the media career as well? Like
I would get really down if I had a bad show.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably not as much as cricket. And I was always told, Martin Crowe, when I started commentary, he said, please don't broadcast how you batted. His advice.
Take some risks.
Martin Sneddon once said to me, my only advice to you, this is post-cricket, he said, take a risk, take some risks. So I was prepared to take risks in broadcasting, and I tried to make sure I enjoyed my broadcasting. But if I had a bad show and stuff things up, I'd chew on that for days. Mm. Without doubt.
Oh my God. I think it's just your character type, right? It's who you are. Yeah. You dropped some great names then, Sneddon and Crow. There's another name I want to drop, Shane Warne. You're one of the only people that I've heard talk about Shane Warne and I really respect you for doing this. You haven't rewritten history. Like, it'd be easy after he dies to say, oh, yeah, me and Shane, we were this or we were that. But you guys famously just did not like
each
other.
We hate each other's guts. And I wear that as a badge of honour because I was living rent-free in his head. He lives rent-free in my head. And I think for a long time I was straight, because he would still mention me. Like, years later, he'd be in interviews and someone would text me and go, hey, Warnie just said something about you on the X show feed.
In what context? Like, after you retired?
After we retired. I think we just did not like each other.
Was that because...
And I thought, well, for a start, I thought, why are you spending any time worrying about what you think about me? You know, I'm not even in your cricketing hemisphere, and yet he did not like me, and I did not like him. But when he passed away, I was quite sad, because... You talk to so many people in the game who knew Warnie, they loved him. He was a lovable rogue, and I think if you were in his good books, he would do anything for you, and he was a great man to be around. Mm. I never saw that, and I never ever got an opportunity, because our paths did cross post-cricket. I never got an opportunity to see the Shane Warne that everyone loved.
Mm.
I just saw this bloke that I resented that crossed the line with me, who didn't like me and I didn't like him.
So who didn't like the other one? Did he not like you? So you're like, well, fuck you, I don't like you either? Or it feels like there was almost like an unspoken feud between you two.
Yeah, I think I might have said something or looked the wrong way at some point. And
is it because you caught him out on 99?
No, it was before that.
Right. Okay, before that.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he crossed the line, I think. There's competitiveness and there's gamesmanship and there's sledging, and then there's just, I think, crossing the line of human decency. And at times out on the field, I think he crossed that with me.
Like, can you remember specifics?
Oh, just things, you know, just things and just going on and on and on.
Like, what things? You don't want to share? Or?
Oh, yeah, it's just hard to come up with specifics.
Yeah,
but
okay.
To one point, I can remember him even Flem. I was batting with Flem. No, I was running the drinks out. I wasn't even playing. I was running the drinks out, and Flem was batting. And Warnie just walked past and just started up. And to the point that Flem actually, who really got on brilliantly with Shane, they were friends. I think Flem even said, mate, Shane, that's gone a bit far.
Just nasty. Was he nasty to you?
We're all competitive people. But we're all people as well.
Mm.
And, you know, just because you're a certain level of cricket above someone else doesn't make you a better person than them.
Mm.
And I think we all have to be prepared to interact on a personal level. And you can't hide behind the fact that it was out there in the middle and then we all share a beer and have a laugh about it if you've gone too far. And with me, he went too far. And so we didn't get on. Do you have to get on with everyone? No.
Yeah, well, you don't like everyone. You can't.
But I'm sad that I never got to know the Shane that everyone loved.
Because I had Ryan Fox on the podcast, and they were sort of friends. And he said Shane wasn't much of a drinker, hated drugs, but when he did get on the drink, it was like Jaeger bombs. Or this is the most Shane Warne thing ever.
I think Shane Warne's going to do something, does it properly, doesn't
he? Yeah, Jaeger bombs or Red Bull vodka, something really awful like that. Yeah.
He's in my top five cricketers ever. He was just a genius. He really was.
Well, he obviously had a respect for you. That must be where the...
I did all right against him. I scored some runs against him in some warm-up games and some games in England when I was playing for different teams. And initially I played him quite well. But, yeah, there was just there was just something there. Yeah.
Well, because of that relationship, that must have been so satisfying, catching him out on 99 runs.
Oh, yeah.
So he died without a test.
Take this the right way. I love that. And that's how cricket should be. Cricket should always beat you in some way,
way, shape, or
form. So the greater, and I think that Sir Don is the greatest sports person ever, because I don't think anyone has dominated their, so Don Bradman, to non-cricket followers, no one has ever dominated their game or their sport to the same level that he dominated when he was playing.
Mm.
And so he averaged 99 over a career. The closest anyone's got to that is about 60 or something like that. It's a 40-run difference.
Mm.
And, you know, an amazing – the world's greats are in the 50s, 55. Mm. He was 99 over a decent career. I think, you know,
it's never going to be repeated.
Schumacher, you know, Kelly Slater,
Tiger.
They've never dominated their sport to the degree that he did. And he needed 4 runs to average 100, and he got a duck. Averaged 99, couldn't average 100 in his final innings. Shane Warne, really good batter, genius of the game of cricket. Deserved 100, never got 100. So in some way, shape, or form, the game beats you. You don't clock the game. And so I sort of quite like that.
But the fact that it had to be you, like his nemesis in a way, to catch him out on 99.
I remember it too, because I just felt he's going to whack one out here. He's going to whack one out here. And he did. I just remember thinking when the ball went up, I think the first thing that came to my mind was, oh, you absolute arsehole, because I've got to catch this now. And it was like, this ball, as it's coming towards you, it should be getting bigger. It was getting smaller, I reckon. It was just the pressure of the moment. Mm. Everyone knew how significant that moment was. And yeah, managed to catch it.
And then you bowed at the crowd.
Was
that a spontaneous thing? You're happy about that, or you regret it afterwards?
Well, I was standing in front of the rowdy part of the whacker, and you know, you're taking so much crap. Felt the most appropriate thing to do was take a bow.
Oh, it's lucky you weren't assassinated that day.
But the media afterwards actually asked me, oh, did you consider maybe dropping it? Because, you know, Shane deserves to get a test 100. And they were actually genuine with their questions. I thought, for God's sake, guys.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, sport.
Yeah.
But he's stoked. Of course I didn't want to drop it. Let him get 100.
Okay, so then you make the transition from cricket to media. So you retire on your own terms. It seems like it was a well-played strategic move. In your own words, you thought if you end up getting dropped, then you'll just be another dropped cricketer and you'll have no worth in the media. So you sort of leave on your own terms and then you get into media. In terms of like transferable skills, like from professional sport, like cricket into media, was there any? What did you take from
performance? I think the fact when you walk into that arena, you perform. It's a performance game, without a doubt. Broadcasting, it's a magnification of yourself. It's the red light goes on, the umpire says play, and you got to perform, and it's nervous. You get nervous, and you've got to overcome the anxiety. And I think the other thing is, you know, you're always trying to get better and improve, and you are like that with sports. So without a doubt, there is there's some similarities. Mm. And you're right. I got out of the game slightly earlier than I should have, basically because, you know, sell high. Mm. So, yeah.
Some Forsyth Barr chat there.
Yeah, my stocks were up there and I needed to sell. I needed to cash them in, you know.
Yeah. Now, one of the most successful things you've done, I think, is The Block, like a reality show that's just gone, chugged on like a juggernaut year after year. You were there since day one, like Ben and Libby.
Yeah.
Day one. It's an incredible innings, to use a cricket term. So Julie Christie cast you for that.
Yeah.
And you came on her radar after that sketch you did with Stephen Fleming?
Is that how? No, I think she was a Cry Goes Wild fan. It was the sketch with Stephen Fleming that got me the Cry Goes Wild gig.
Right.
And then
what was that? Let's focus on that for a little bit. So it was like a stitch up.
Yes.
But no one realized it was a stitch up at the time. The acting's phenomenal. Like Stephen Fleming.
Well, I don't think it is acting. That's the thing. Because we've all seen him do his Fujitsu ads.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think there was an element of truth in it, you know?
Okay, thanks. Good luck.
Thanks, mate.
Hey, you're an idiot.
That's ridiculous. Seriously, that's ridiculous. Two things. You forgot who your mates are. Some of your comics. Shane, your moon. The other thing is just an idiot. You're talking about scoring rates and picking up the tempo of games. So you're one of the most boring players to watch. So from what I've seen so far in your commentary position, it's crap. Remember your mates up, mate? It's about 6 months ago you were with us.
Yeah, but he plays his part perfectly, like sprays at you and then walks away, and then you look like embarrassed.
Yeah.
Like there's not a hint of a grin or a twinkle in your eye, like we've got some gold here. So how did that come about?
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking this is
it was.
This is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that was – I was doing the cricket show. So I was doing the commentary and I was doing the, and I was doing the magazine-style show, and we thought, let's do a behind-the-scenes story on commentary, day in commentary. And it was like – and I was always looking for some a different angle and do something entertaining. So I thought, how about we do a story whereby I'm the new boy in commentary, which I was, and I just – everyone just gives me crap and it's really hard. And then we thought, well, what? And then I was thinking, what about if, and then I go to interview the captain and he just lets me have it and, you know, tells me I'm rubbish at it. And this is my life in commentary now was the story. So we were, there was the, our camera op knew what was going on and our producer knew, and Flynn knew, because I'd said, hey, why don't you just, you know, tell me, you just tee off on me. And the interview was real because it was raining and it was an opportunity to do it. And Flem said he'd come out and do an interview for the actual broadcast. So we did this interview in the can, and then he was meant to stop, and then sort of we'd almost repo, and then he'd let me have it and we'd pick it up on our Eng camera. But he just, thanks, and then he just charged into it. Of course, then all the cameras just like that, and it's all the broadcast cameras and our Eng camera for the show. Flem does it. You should there, and then all of a sudden, when it finishes, we start laughing. You should have seen the media liaison officer was just white.
Oh my just, god! Yeah, I can imagine. This is a big fire to put out.
He'd done this so well, and then I've gone bouncing into our commentary area where we wait, and like the TV was off, and they're all sitting there acting all this like. You know, they hadn't seen it. But apparently they'd seen it and they switched it off because they thought it was for real as well, like Kenzie and Smithy and all these other commentators. And I've come bouncing and going, did you see that? That's fucking awesome.
Gold.
And they tweaked that it was a stitch-up. Then later on, Flem heard that he was really good. So he wanted to see. And by this stage, though, our satellite links were up. And the producer at the time ran it through the truck. And of course, it ran through the truck, and now it's picked up. While he watched it, now it's been picked up all around the world. So it was someone on Willow TV in the West Indies is sitting there, obviously maybe having to do a news story on the West Indies New Zealand cricket game, and thought, "God, look at this! I've got gold." And then it just went around the world.
That was amazing. If TikTok was around at the time, that would have been blown up even bigger. It was massive.
Way that launched my media career. Yeah, something silly like that.
Incredible.
Because Rick Salizzo, who was putting together The Crowd Goes Wild, looked at that when that is just perfect for Crowd Goes Wild. That's the image I've got in my mind for the show that I'm going to do. And so said, do you want to be involved? And then Julie was a Crowd Goes Wild fan, I think, and she thought, nice to have someone, you know, like that, maybe do The Block. So she got me the gig doing The Block.
That's the strange thing about you, eh? So there's this incredibly playful side, guy that doesn't mind taking the piss out of himself, will do anything for a laugh, like at your own expense or someone else's. But then just this seriously deep thinking, self-loathing, you know, the intense thinker.
I think
quite a crazy juxtaposition.
I plan things out. I'm a planner. So I just like to see a blueprint of where I'm heading.
Yeah.
But I also knew that one of my skills is that self-deprecating sort of humor that I have, and it resonates with New Zealanders, I guess. That's just what I've tried to do.
Yeah.
So when I did take my broadcasting deadly serious, but I took being a bit of a clown deadly serious. Not a comedian. I've never said that I was a comedian, but I knew that my point of difference was just to be someone that people could have a laugh. They could laugh with me laughing at myself.
Yeah. I think there's something really powerful in that as well, because not everyone has the ability to do that.
Well, some people, I think, you know, I think you do have to have a degree of mental strength to be able to let others laugh at you. You know, it's –
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're prepared to be laughed at, you need to be fairly
– resilient.
Yeah, and I think assured in your own shoes.
Yeah. Jeez, I've kept you so long. We've probably got time for one more story, though. We've got time for one more story.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the Jacinda Ardern stuff. Yeah. This is probably the big – you reflect on that now. So this was on the AM show.
Yeah. Early years. Yeah,
Jacinda Ardern as Prime Minister was there. What was it something about
She was leader of the opposition at that point. Okay. She'd just become the leader of the opposition.
So what was the comment? Something about whether she planned to get pregnant or not.
It got strewed very, very quickly. The night before she was on the project and I was on the project, and Jesse Mulligan and Aminah Naren about, do I ask the question about becoming the leader of opposition, you're going to get a lot busier. You've mentioned in the media before that you want to have a family. And so he was to ask the question, so very apologetically asked this question about, so what does this mean for your plans to have a family now? And she answered it. And then, of course, it just goes, media grabs it and they want to just, you know, they run with it. And was that a fair question? And the culture that existed, you know, at that time, it still does probably. And so the question was it a fair question? And she was sitting on the couch and I was saying on the AIM show before she came on that I said, yeah, it's a fair question. I just think that, you know, your staff are your biggest asset. And if you know this information, you can plan for the future and it's a win-win. So I wasn't saying you use that against anyone. Mm. She then came on and then she wanted to take me to task for it. And she did. And I fought my case. And when the, and it wasn't about her, it was about whether the question was legit for an employer to be able to ask it. And my rationale was always, it is for the sake of information sharing and planning in advance, not for getting rid of people. Maybe quite naive to think that way. She said it wasn't appropriate. It was fair enough to ask her, but not anyone else. And that's her point of view, and many would agree with that. I fought my case. Cameras stopped rolling. She got up and said, great debate. See you next week. And then the media just ran with it. And it got more misconstrued. I got sold down the road, I believe, by my own network. It was a great moment for me, though. That was the thing. And
what do you mean it was a great moment? Must have felt like you were walking through hell.
I was villain number one, but I was quite happy. And the other thing was what the media never reported was there was actually a lot of support for me as well. But that wasn't part of the narrative.
No. Well, it didn't suit the narrative. Yeah, you've got a young female leader and a pale male stale.
Yeah, and my argument and defense of myself has never, ever seen the light of day. You had to be watching it live. That's never really, it's never been shown. It moved me into another sphere when it came to broadcasting, and quite frankly, it was good for me.
It's like Paul Henry. There's those memorable moments in broadcasting, like Paul Henry with the Sheila Dixit thing. But when you're going through that, can't be like
I was arch enemy number one, and my kids were finding out that apparently everyone hated their dad. Not everyone hated their dad, but when their kids, and they were young kids, that was when I started to get pretty annoyed with the whole thing. But I realized I was playing with the big boys now, and I wanted to make it in that form of media, and you know, I believed in what I said. The other thing is you don't have to be right all the time. It's okay to be wrong. And if my argument went to the court of law and I lost, I accept that. The other thing was all of a sudden people, Mark Richardson's put us back 40 years. No, I haven't. The law, I don't set the law. No one's going to change the law because I say. But hopefully people will watch the AM show for what I say.
It's funny. People are funny. Like it was just a question, and it's just an opinion, or it's just a thought. And then you have people that, because you may say one thing that they don't like, they'll be like, "Well, I have to disagree and loathe everything about that person."
And not only that is that now you're not allowed to have an opinion any longer. It's like,
why would you bother? I'd say, like with the Jacinda Ardern thing, there'd be a lot of people that probably shared your thoughts, but would just be like, it's not my battle, circus, not my monkeys.
Well, I think right now in broadcasting, I think it's sad. I think we have become vanilla for the sake of survival. And I reckon that's really sad. I'm very excited about Ryan Bridge actually moving into 7 p.m. I think he'll provide a slightly different, you know, narrative.
Oh, Ryan Bridge, you outed him on TV.
Yeah.
Accidentally.
Well, I maintain it's done great things. For him, you know? I was mortified and shocked with myself because I'd let a mate down. I really respect the reasons why he wanted to remain in the closet in a broadcasting sense, because he didn't want to have to become some sort of spokesperson and a representative of the rainbow community. He just wanted to be the fellow who's a damn good political interviewer, not labelled with the gay guy who's a political interviewer. Mm. And it's exactly what happened the minute he came out. But then I think people have moved past that and they realise just how good he is.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you, so who are you friends with? You're friends with Duncan Garner, right? Yeah, like I've heard you call him an actual mate.
We've drifted away a little bit because of life's moved on, but I like Duncan. I think he genuinely likes and cares about people. And I think that shows in his broadcasting. He's passionate about broadcasting, but he genuinely does actually like people.
Yeah.
And wants to help. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, this has been great. Man, we're going to have to reschedule and get you back another time because I feel like we're just scratching the surface of the Mark Richardson story.
Yeah.
You're such an intriguing guy.
Well, when you obviously make a fortune in the podcast world and
invest
maybe,
it with
and maybe license it and sell the license and make a fortune, make sure you come and knock on my door as well.
Absolutely. But do you want to get a plug-in? You want to get a plug-in for your services?
Oh, no. It's just nice to get it out there because I do have to, you know, rebrand a little bit and get it out there that I'm now an investment advisor with Foresight Bar. Taking it deadly serious and still always got to be me and we'll always have the background as a sports person or broadcaster, but you know, I'm a financial advisor now.
And I reckon you're going to do, and I've said this a couple of times, it's not just pissing in your pocket, but I think you're going to do bloody well at it. I think there's people that have like a fixed mindset or a growth mindset, and most athletes have like a growth mindset. And I mean, yeah, you excelled at your sport, you excelled at media, and you're going to excel at this.
Well, the great thing about, if you do well at this now, with the way the compliance and regulations are, if you're doing well at this job, at my job, investment advising, then the people you're advising for are doing well. So it's a win-win.
Mm.
I think in the old days, maybe, you know, in an unregulated cowboy world, you could make a lot of money in brokerage and perhaps, you know, you didn't care about the result for the person who you were selling securities to. But now that is not, it's not how it works. It's not how it'll ever work again.
Mm.
So if you're doing well at this gig, then everyone's doing well, which is, it's a great model.
Don't understand a word of what you just said, but I appreciate your time. You're a great New Zealander, and I can't thank you enough for coming over and being on the podcast.
Oh, good on you, mate. It's fun. It's great. I'm honored to be able to come and talk on it.
Mark Richardson on the Dom Harvey podcast. What do you think? Any feedback, suggestions, constructive criticism, anything like that? I've genuinely got no idea really what I'm doing. I'm just having interesting conversations with people that I'm fascinated by. But ultimately, it's a podcast and a show for you guys. So if you have any feedback, constructive criticism, whatever, love to hear from you. Message me anytime. I'm on Instagram, domharveynz, or email me, domharveynz@gmail.com. Quick shout out to my sponsors before we sign off. And a very quick request to you guys as well. Please, if you like the content, please do consider supporting these brands. Their involvement in the podcast has made it possible to expand, buy new gear, grow my team, and ultimately get better guests. I really want this thing to be as big as possible. You know, like a career rather than a hobby. And that dream is becoming a reality thanks to legends like Generate and Radix. A couple of epic Kiwi-owned and operated companies. Generate is a KiwiSaver scheme. Radix is a nutrition company, both of them killing it in their respective fields. I've got all the links and additional information in the description to this episode, so please, when you've got a minute, look that up and do consider supporting them. Radix products can help you live longer and healthier. That means you'll need more money when you retire. And Generate can probably help you with that. They have a long record of chart-topping performance. If you want to make sure you're making the most of your KiwiSaver account, chat to an advisor now. Again, the link is in the description. A copy of their product disclosure statement can be found there too. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. Hey, thanks again, genuinely, from the bottom of my heart. Really appreciate you guys being along and listening to the entire podcast. And I hope to see you next week on the Dom Harvey podcast. See ya.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.